Welcome to episode 13 of the Pivot Podcast Series. My name is Marcel Dupapé, and I am your co-host along with my colleague Jeff Potier. And we are very excited to be joined today by Brett Himmelman. Brett joins us fresh off the back of competing at the 2022 ICF Canoe Sprint and Para Canoe World Championships that took place on Lake Binnook in his home province of Nova Scotia, where Brett captured the bronze medal in the C2 men's 1,000-meter race with Craig Spence. Brett is also a member of the RBC Olympian team and is a recent graduate of St. Mary's University, where he earned his Bachelor of Commerce degree with distinction. Brett Himmelman, welcome to the Pivot Podcast today, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on. Really excited to join you guys and be a part of the show.
Amazing. We look forward to it. I have to ask you right off the hop, Brett, could you take us back to race day at the Canoe 22 World Championships this past summer? You wake up, you know you're about to compete in the final of the C2 1,000-meter race against the best athletes in the world, and in your hometown, no less. Could you walk us through how you start your day, knowing you're competing in this huge race? Take us through the race itself and how you felt after you crossed the finish line and realized you made the podium representing Team Canada. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it really started like I didn't really need to wake up to an alarm. Like I got pretty lucky with my race schedule. I only raced 2 of the 5 days of the world. So it was really a long 5 days because there was like so much suspense, so much buildup. Like just watching the whole first day with all the crowds and everything. Like I was just so excited. I just wanted to go. And then we ended up going direct the final right out of the heats, which was awesome. That's what we wanted to do, especially with how hot it was on Lake Binnook this summer. But it also gave 2 full days between our heat and our final to kind of just mentally prepare, or in some cases just mentally stew. But when I woke up that morning, I woke up at around 7. I was just so excited. I'd be like, okay, I want to race now. I want to race in the next like 30 minutes. But I just the whole day, like just trying to either settle the combination between nerves and excitement. Me and my partner, we have very different strategies when it comes to what we eat in the morning, but he kind of runs off of coffee and just like small meals, where I ended up going the pure and simple, having the biggest breakfast I possibly could right outside the hotel, because they really tried to make it almost kind of like we were away at a competition, even though we were in our own backyard. So they had us in a hotel. We had like shuttle buses to take us to and from the course. So it was almost kind of like we were home, but we kind of had to have that mentality like, oh, yeah, we're at a world championships on the road. Doesn't matter that we're in our own backyard. We still got to focus the same way, regardless of where it is. But the big thing was just trying to like really keep myself from kind of calming down, like when you know you got the German team and the Chinese team, they're both powerhouses, especially when it comes to the C2000. They're both Olympic medalists in this event at the last Olympics, both crews. And you look over at the German crew, where they got Sebastian Brendel, who's the greatest canoer of all time. He's the Sidney Crosby of canoeing. He's the modern day GOAT, the greatest. And just to see him across there and knowing you're racing against him, it's like you have to bring your best, because even if their best is the best, you know that no matter what, you're on that line, you really are going up against the best in the world. But wow. once I got out there, once I kind of completed my warm up, all those nerves and all that excitement, I just really was able to convert that to focus.
And so, you know, gun goes off, you're in the race. Just kind of walk us through kind of that feeling of being in the heat of competition and then what it felt like across the finish line.
Yeah, so I mean, our sport's very linear. Like it's for a sport that sometimes can seem very complicated in terms of technique. When you're in the race, it's as simple as it gets. You're getting the point A, the point B, straight down as fast as possible. And when you're just trying to do that, the best thing you can do really is just try and look down your lane and pretend that those buoys on either side of you are just walls. That you don't look at anybody else, you don't look to your left, you don't look to your right, you just try and execute our race plan. And I give credit to my partner Craig because he's 3 years older than me. He is a bit more experienced. He's a bit more of a veteran in the sport. He had a perfect race plan that we kind of set out together, being like, look, if we do this, this is how we're going to be in our race. And then if we look over with 200 meters left, we'll be where we want to be. And I pretty much looked straight down the course the whole time. I didn't really look to see where everybody else was. We had the Chinese crew right beside us on our right, so we kind of saw them in our peripheral, and we knew they would be ahead off the start. But we kept them in our vision, in our sight. And I was like, okay, if we're up with them, then we're in the right spot where we want to be, because we knew where we wanted to be fighting on the podium. And I didn't know where we were the whole race. We could have been fourth, fifth, or sixth, or we could have been second or third. I really couldn't tell from where we were. I was just looking straight down the lane. But then with 150 to go, I kind of look over and there's only three of us like up at the front. And I'm like, oh my goodness, are we actually going to do this? Are we actually going to get a bronze medal? We earlier that year, we had a really hard fourth place when we were racing at the World Cup in Czech, where we just got knocked off the podium by the Polish crew by 0.2 seconds. And then at the following World Cup in Poland that year, we ended up getting a bronze medal, but the same Polish crew just beat us out for the silver medal that time. A medal was kind of like the stretch goal. Like if we could be on the podium, that would be huge. Like that's the ultimate goal. For me personally, I was like, if we beat the Polish crew, that would be a big accomplishment for me. It didn't matter what the result would be. I'd be happy if we just beat them, because they were a crew we were so close to the whole season. To beat them really felt like that we've improved throughout the summer.
0.2 seconds, Brett. How often does it come down to something that close? Is that pretty normal?
For a 1,000-meter race, you'd be surprised by how close it can be at times, especially the C2 500 meters, which we've raced at the World Cups before too. Like you could have all nine crews in the final be within 2 seconds of each other. You could have four crews fighting for a podium between 0.1 seconds. And I've even had some of my own individual races go down to 0.01 seconds before to decide who wins. And it can come down to literally 2-3 centimeters. It's crazy how sometimes in a race that can be as long as 4 minutes go down to such a small time frame. It's a part of the sport that still kind of baffles me and kind of surprises me at times, because I grew up like playing team sports. Like I played hockey and lacrosse, and a lot of that is you go for the buzzer, but there's a scoreboard and not a timer. So it was definitely a bit of a transition for me when you think like, wow, like you can work that hard and be that close on either side of it, sometimes on the winning side and sometimes unfortunately on the other side.
Yeah, well, it kind of comes back to you saying, well, it can be technical at times, but also simple once you get started going. I'm kind of curious, as it relates to your training and things like that. You commented that, one of the German fellows was, what do you say, the Sidney Crosby of canoeing, perhaps? And I'm wondering, like, what makes someone the best at this? Is it largely technical training? Is it cardiovascular ability? Is it strength? I actually watched that race and not in person, but I watched it just, prior to this podcast. And I'm thinking to myself, like, by the end of that race, I suspect you don't have a whole lot of breath left. Right. So obviously that's got to be one factor. Like, what portion of this is cardiovascular training and weigh out, and what portion of it is technical? Like, what makes someone the best at this?
It's really the combination of both. Like, our sport is very much like muscular and speed endurance. We do a lot of kilometers in our training week. So even though our race is only 4 minutes long or less, we in the heat of a training season, we're doing well over 100 kilometers a week on the water.
Oh, wow.
And during like the bulk, kind of like the thickest part of training camps, where we're like in the middle of February, March, kind of well away from competition season, we could be doing up to 150 kilometers a week, sometimes even more. What kind of makes someone the best in this sport is how long can you go, like how long can you hold at that threshold, paddling your best strokes at your best technique? Because everybody can take a good technical stroke at this level for 10 strokes, 15 strokes, or however long they need to do, but to be able to do it for a full, whether it's a 200, a 500, a 1,000 meter race at that speed, that's a separator right there.
So Marcel and I have both, you know, we run, we exercise various capacities, things like that. You said threshold. Maybe I'm nerding out a bit here. Are you guys paying attention to your heart rate and stuff? Like, you're doing a lot of training volume. Are you trying to maintain a particular zone there? How do you know you're not overdoing it?
So our training zones is something that our whole training program is based around the general aerobic one, which training zone, which is around 70% of your max heart rate.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's where we do the bulk of our training. That's where we do, let's just say probably 75 to 80% of our kilometers are all done within that training zone there. So yeah, like stuff like heart rate, for us, it's really important. What we're trying to do is we're, for especially those long paddles, we're trying to basically be as fast as we can at a certain stroke rate. So that kind of general aerobic 70% heart rate zone that just mentioned, that's around about 38 to 40 strokes per minute for us. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to stay within that heart rate zone, stay within that stroke rate zone, but try and be as fast as we can without going out of that zone.
So Brett, to get to be the best of the best at anything, I mean, and this podcast is kind of called The Pivot for a reason. Like Jeff and I ask all of our guests about that pivotal moment that completely changes the direction of your life. And I wanted to ask you about your moment. Like, where were you in your life and what happened to make you want to become an elite athlete in this sport?
Yeah, so what kind of made me want to become an elite athlete in this sport really was I started the sport when I was 15 years old. My grandpa dropped me off at my canoe club, didn't even register me or anything. He just dropped me off at the front door and say, go get in shape for hockey and lacrosse, because one of his good friends had kids that paddled before. And it was only until 2 weeks later when they realized, I was like, oh, well, registration's been full for a while, but you've been here and you work hard and we like having you around here. So we'll let you stay. Just sign up and pay the fee so you can race. But what really kind of made me want to pursue this at like elite level was when I finished my first nationals. And my goal was just to try and race the singles event at that nationals. And that was 2014. And that first fall, I was learning how to canoe. And it was a lot of falling in the lake, spinning around in circles. The story that the kids always like when I started off was I ended up hitting a tree in the lake. There was a fallen over tree in Kearney Lake. And it's a 5 kilometer lake and perimeter, 2.5K long. And there's only one little tree you could possibly hit. And somehow I hit it in the lake. And kids are like, how'd you hit that? And I'm like, that's me struggling to learn how to steer. But what was kind of a pivotal moment in my kind of career where this happened last fall, where we had nationals at late and I had a really good national result. I ended up finishing third at the nationals, which was the national team trials that year, which was my best result to date. However, I just missed out on world team selection. I missed out on under 23 worlds that year on a tiebreaker, and I just missed out on senior worlds in a winner take all race. And that was really hard for me because I had my best results to date, but to still miss out on every team because I raced for Canada at both World Cups, Pan Ams and World Championships this year. But the last time I raced for Canada in the spring canoe race before that was 2018. So that was a four year gap between me racing on the international world stage. Which is a long time. It was a lot of years of just disappointingly making missing teams, and they ended up taking away my funding money in that fall too. I just missed out on getting my government carding check, and that was really disappointing because it was like I did everything I could. I had my best results to date, yet it seemed like everything didn't work out for me. It was like there was a couple moments, if I'm being honest, I'm just like, I'm graduated now. Like this is really hard to keep doing, and it's also very expensive to keep doing. They ended up moving our national camps out west to California. They used to be east in Florida, and the costs ended up astronomically rising. And I was like, okay, well, this is going to be an all in. It's when the not to use like a poker reference, but like it was a time where I had to kind of put my chips all in. I was like, okay, got to take money out of the savings. I got to go do this camp. I got to go run in full head of steam. And this is the year where I really got to get results. Cause if I don't get that funding money back this year, I'm not making teams, and the bank's going to run dry, and I might be running dry as well too. So I pushed the chips all in, and I put a couple bets on myself. I really had to maneuver my way to afford those camps. I ended up staying on a buddy's couch in California for the, I got really lucky. I had a really good friend, Doug, who really helped me out a lot, mitigating some of those costs before I joined the national team camp. But it was a lot of kind of perseverance for when I got the call that they were taking away my funding. It was like, okay, is this the moment here? Am I going to use this to motivate me to push even further to try and find a new level out of myself? Or is this where I'm going to roll over and die almost? But I felt like I found a whole new gear, a whole new motivation, which brought me from someone who was a bubble Team Canada paddler to someone who was able to represent Canada and have a lot of success.
So every time we've got any serious athlete that comes on here, we hear a lot of the same themes, like, you know, perseverance, dealing with disappointments, setbacks, those things, right? And I'm always curious, like, you know, many people in the same situation might have quit, or maybe barely even started, right? And I'm always curious to, coming back to, you know, the running comment I made earlier, what makes someone stop at 9 instead of, you know, finishing a 10K? What makes someone just not quit and double down and believe in themselves? Do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really tough to be like, I was so disappointed after that nationals. Like when I crossed the line, when I finished my race, I was so excited because I was like, I had my best national result to date. Like I was on the podium at the national team trials that year for the first time. I was like, okay, like I've moved up the ranking list. But then like thinking of myself after, when I missed out on all the teams to take away my funding, I was like so disappointed. But I realized I was so disappointed in the result, not disappointed in myself, not disappointed in what I did. And that was kind of the like difference maker for me, was that it was like for me to keep kind of pushing on and to really try and find that next gear for next season. Cause I was like, okay, I did everything I could to get my best result. I had a good result and I did everything I could to execute. I can't control the results, and I can't control sometimes how teams are selected and how the funding money goes. Those are stuff that's out of my control, but I did everything that I can in my control. If I keep doubling down on that, then I wanted to put myself in a position where there was going to be no doubt whether I made a team, or there was going to be no doubt whether I get my funding or not. I wanted to work extra hard to get myself off that bubble. And I think it almost took me needing to be almost knocked down a peg to really motivate myself to be like, okay, instead of just climbing up one step, let's go make a big leap here.
Brett, just to play off this theme of setbacks, you were diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety at age 13, and you've been pretty open about your struggles in the interest of helping other athletes dealing with everything from the pressures of competition to other general life stresses, I guess. And I was just wondering, to the extent that you're comfortable sharing, of course, what was your life like before and leading up to your diagnosis? And what kinds of adjustments did you and your family need to make in order for you to find your, call it, new normal and stay healthy after being diagnosed with OCD and anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, my anxiety really affected me a lot, mostly in kind of social situations. Like it affected me a lot in school. I wasn't like at its peak when I was like 13. I was very heavily medicated. I was seeing a lot of therapy. I really had to like just focus on what was like positive outlets for me too, because I used to get myself overwhelmed in situations where I need to tell myself over and over that I was like, okay, like things are okay, but if something wasn't okay, I would, it led to a lot of spirals. What really kind of got me kind of like, I'd say you mentioned the word kind of new normal. Because it's not something that just kind of goes away. It's just something that's kind of managed better. When I was like 13, when I was a young teenager, I was managing OCD, but I was managing it very like publicly per se. Like people could clearly see that I was struggling. People could clearly see that I was not okay, or I was shutting myself off socially, or I was acting out. I still have to manage obsessive compulsive disorders, but the big thing now that I kind of have to tell myself is that it was like, okay, if I can't think of how it, if I can't think of a rational reason how this affects me, then it's clear that the hardest part is separating for me the rational thoughts and irrational thoughts. A prime example that I always kind of use, and I was really bad for this, especially starting off in paddling, was that if I had one bad practice, I used to think that like, oh, I'm a bad paddler. I regress so much. Like what did I do wrong? Like, was there something I could have changed? Like those were all irrational thoughts, to the point where it's like, okay, like just because I had one bad time control or even just one bad race doesn't mean that everything I did leading up into that point was nothing and everything just went wrong for whatever reason. It was a lot of self-talk, a lot of just trying to like calm myself down, trying to like keep myself out of my own head, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And I guess I'm curious to know about when you're talking to other athletes that maybe don't have OCD or but struggle mentally, are these the kinds of conversations that you have? It's you know, what works for you in terms of positive self-talk? Are there any other outlets that you recommend? Or what does that sound like when you're talking to another athlete like yourself?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is because I've done talks to groups, and I've also helped out some individual athletes. I think the biggest thing that especially athletes kind of struggle with is that they think that what they're kind of going through is so unique to them, which everybody deals with, whether it's a mental illness or struggles differently. But to know that you have other athletes that are also going through similar things, that's like what I always found was really positive for me as an athlete to talk to other athletes about, is that you're not alone in this. Like sometimes, like especially in our sport, where we spend sometimes anywhere up to 4 to 6 months away from our family, it can feel really lonely at times. Like your family and friends, or they're at home, and then you're away at camp, and sometimes it kind of feels like you're struggling on your own. But what I kind of say to younger athletes that are struggling with whatever it might be, whether it's mental illness or even if it's just like it's starting a new age group and paddling, you're paddling against older people, like it's okay to not feel okay. It's okay to kind of feel these things. This doesn't make you any lesser of an athlete. And there's different ways you can manage it. And just like how every kind of situation is different, every athlete is different. But I think if you like athletes being open about their own experiences, if you can hear enough athletes, if I deal with my OCD or my struggles one way, and then let's just say there's another athlete, it could be even from another sport, they deal with their struggles that way. The first person might not resonate with whoever that might be, but then if the more athletes are kind of talking about it, the more younger athletes or other athletes that are struggling can relate to. And I think that's a big reason why I'm open with my struggles with mental illness before, is that even if I can help out just one person to either like give them like a solution on how they can help like calm their own brain, or how they can control their own thoughts, or even just be like a little bit more like positive about their trajectory, like if I can help out one person, then that's more than enough reason to be open about it, because everything I might say about my experiences might not resonate with everybody. But then if we have more and more athletes being open about it, eventually we'll realize that it was like, okay, like we all struggle in some sort of way. We can all help each other out with with the tools we got.
Yeah, hearing you say that, it makes me think of how I think it'd be quite easy to become obsessive in sports. And I've been trying to think, what's the name of that documentary that goes through? It follows Michael Jordan's rise with the Bulls. It just came out the last couple of years. Why am I blanking?
The Last Dance.
Yes, The Last Dance. Well, if you watched that, which I almost assumed you both did, it was great. I mean, I don't know anything about OCD, just to be clear, but it certainly seems to me that he was obsessive at times.
It's very easy to be obsessive of sports, especially in individual sports where you're dealing with times and distances and all that stuff. Like a coach actually gave me very good insight at the World Championships this year, and they were talking about Martin Fuchs, the guy who has the world records, and like he's at the level where he's got the last two, he's broken his own world record twice, he's got the world record, but just because if he doesn't do a world record time at every single race, is he disappointed with every single one of his races? No, obviously not. There's so many other factors you can control, and factors that you can't control that sometimes determine, but it's very easy to be so hyper fixated and hyper focused on results and numbers, especially in a sport where you're always comparing yourselves to the others. It can be very obsessive, but the way you kind of have to control that is you almost kind of have to separate everything or compartmentalize. Like for me, when I'm on the water, like I really focus on everything I can do. But when I'm off the water, I need to kind of take a step away from paddling. I need to think about other things. Not everybody plays a second sport as their hobby to end up kind of like as their outlet. But I think it's very important to kind of have a mental outlet, whether it's another sport, whether it's school, whether it's I even during the beginning of the pandemic, I even took up painting as something that which is something that's incredibly off the board for me, for anybody who knows me. But like for back to the point about Martin, it's just because you're not breaking your own world record every single race doesn't mean that's you have to be disappointed with it. It's all about kind of perspective, really.
I guess I'm curious, like, do you think that OCD or perhaps some of those tendencies you may have ended up perhaps serving you in you know, serving you well as it relates to being a professional athlete?
100%, because you need to have that obsessiveness to get to the next level, because that kind of obsessiveness that I have into me, it's yes, it's also caused me struggles in the past, but if I control it, it also can be the fuel for my engine, for my drive. It really is, because like being obsessive to the point where it takes over your whole life and you can't think of anything outside of your sport, that's where it becomes problematic and sometimes unhealthy. But where you're obsessing to like each practice to try and get a little bit better, to improve your technique a little bit more, to have that drive, it really is, I think it's an important thing for all successful athletes. You really need, and there isn't, and like you mentioned, like Michael Jordan, like if he wasn't so about winning, that's a driver that takes you from great to the greatest. It's you need a little bit of obsessiveness to get through to the next level, because without it, it's very easy to stay where you're at.
Brett, just to switch gears, speaking as a parent, I know a lot of parents whose kids show, shall we call it, early promise in sport, for any sport for that matter. And some parents really struggle with how much is too much or too little to encourage their child to train and compete in their chosen sport. Because I think most of us have experienced, maybe directly or indirectly, parents' intensity when it comes to their child in competitive sport. You know, sometimes to the point where kids simply burn out or leave the sport entirely, despite the fact that they demonstrated the so-called early promise. So I guess I was just wondering, what are your thoughts and personal experiences when it comes to that? And what kind of support do you feel is ideal for a young athlete to realize their full potential?
So like the early promise thing, you mentioned that, and especially in a sport like canoe kayak, where we're a very late peaking sport, like a lot of people don't realize their potential until sometimes they're well into their 20s. Like I think the early promise thing, it's not really kind of applicable to our sport. Like there's some people who might get the sport technically early on, but there really isn't. I don't think there's anything, like there's no such thing as an elite 12-year-old athlete, in my opinion, or even like an elite 13, 14-year-old athlete. They're kids doing sports. And I think it's like multi-sport is a very important thing. Like you see with hockey a lot, and I've seen hockey change a lot. I've coached paddling for 6+ years at the U12, the U14 level. I coached high school hockey and I've coached youth lacrosse before. And I think when sports become too serious at an early age, when it actually becomes like when it needs to be serious, that just kind of drive to get there just that doesn't seem to be quite there when and that's not to put all athletes in the one basket, because you hear of some prodigies from when they're 5 years old all the way until they're 15 till they make it to the professional level. But I think it's especially at the young age, it's just for a young athlete, I think the most important thing is just making sure you're enjoying what you're doing. Because I wouldn't be at the level I'm at right now in paddling if I didn't enjoy the sport when I was 15, 16 years old. Especially in some sports, they kind of expect you to be like almost year-round athletes. You got to make sure that you still have balance, because there's a reason why it's called a long career. Like if you've been a full-time athlete from you look at an NHL player, for example, they join the NHL when they're 18 years old, but they've been a full-time athlete, some of them, since they've been 12, 13, 14 years old.
Putting myself in your shoes, when your grandfather dropped you off at, I think you said Massqua, randomly, right? This was not planned. It was just something for you to do to cross train for hockey. You know, you could have been any time, you know, after you fell and hit that tree or done whatever, just said, you know, I'm done with this. But something compelled you to keep going. Like, were there any pep talks or anything that like your parents or grandparents might have said to you or done for you that you were like, you know what, I'm gonna stick at this and finding.
Yeah, well, the big thing for me was that like when I was 15 years old, learning, just trying to start the sport, I wasn't even thinking about like racing for Canada, or like I was just trying to focus on like, okay, like let's just learn the technical base, let's just learn how to do this and have fun at it too. I think that's especially for kids sports, that's the fun needs to be the biggest part about it. And I've seen a lot of kids that I've coached over the years who might have shown early promise from whether they had results at like a provincial championships or just being able to get it technically, that are out of the sport at 15 because they've done it kind of year round, like for 3 years, and just kind of that drive just isn't the same when you aren't enjoying it. Like the first things first, if you're not having fun, then really what's the point of doing it? Like,
yeah, well said.
Are you still having fun, Brett?
I really am. If I wasn't having fun, I wouldn't be doing this today. Our sport is like, for me, it's year round. I get 3 weeks off, which this is my last week off of the year, and then I go back to like training full time for next season starting next week. And not every single day might be the most enjoyable. I know when I'm on the water in late October and you might get like cold rain, it might be freezing. Yeah, I might not be having the time of my life, but when I look at training and I look at like competing and being a part of a team and what I'm doing, I love what I do.
So what's next? Recent win, bronze medal win. What are the plans here for the next few years?
Yeah, so I just said, my 2023 season, it starts next week. So Like 2022, it was an amazing year. Like some might say it might have been a breakout year for me. For me, I say it was a really, really fun summer. it's getting ready for 2023. And 2023 is a very important year for not just me, but for Canada as a paddling team, because that's where we got to qualify our Olympic spots for. Canada just isn't given a spot every year for the Olympics. We gotta qualify it. So we gotta qualify it at the World Championships and at the Pan Am Championships next year. And okay. I'll be starting off on the water here this fall. So I'll be training on Lake Binuk until go away to camps, which are most likely out west in California, but. I haven't heard any official word, but as everybody knows, there's always the rumor mill where you kind of hear information before it officially goes out beforehand. But it's just getting ready for next year to get myself the best I can for the upcoming national team trials, and then go from there to do everything I can to help Canada qualify those spots for the Olympics.
That's great, man. There's somewhere I can't help myself. I caught something in your bio and I want to end on it. What's your favorite Rocky movie? You got to go Rocky IV, right?
I mean, Rocky IV is my favorite just because it's the most it's the cheesiest one.
Oh my God, it's awesome.
I know. It's if you have if like Rocky IV is the one I rewatch the most, because it like if you haven't seen the three before that, if you just watch Rocky IV, it's like, wow, that's got it's got a lot of emotional punch to it. It's got a lot of bam to it. Like, I mean, yeah, like I can't go wrong with Rocky IV, because I agree with you there. Like, I mean, like the first Rocky, it's like everybody knows it's such a well-made movie, but then like you get the Rocky II and it's like, okay, like he beats Apollo, he got that punch. Like Rocky III's got its moments too, but then like if you just watch Rocky IV on its own, it's just like, okay, like this is a movie that I watch to get myself fired up for whatever I need to do. That, you know, it's funny you mentioned The Last Dance. Nationals last year, I was staying in my cousin's house up in Ottawa, and I was rewatching The Last Dance to get myself motivated and excited to race. So.
You got to rewatch that before your next race. You got to watch the training montage from Rocky IV. You'll be so jacked up, you don't even know what you're doing with yourself.
I'd be lying if I said that if I didn't say it on YouTube. If you look at my most frequently watched videos, they're right up there on my YouTube. It's just like, oh yeah, recommended for you. And it's I think you look at 50% of it, you're looking at the stuff from Rocky IV. The Michael Phelps Rise and Shine video as well. My dad sent that to me so many times over the years. We practice early in the morning, like 6 a.m. a lot of times. Now on the national team, we train at 8, which a lot of people still say is early, but for me, that's sleeping in. Growing up doing practices at 6 all the way through, when it's kind of cold and dark, and it can be just as easy to just kind of turn on the snooze alarm, stay in your nice warm bed and warm pajamas. And but if you want to achieve your goals, you want to get it done, you got to get yourself up early.
Right on, man. Well, thanks so much for doing this. This was a lot of fun, a lot of great stuff in here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. It was nice chatting with both of you.